Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, Horror Movies You Changed Your Mind On. So this episode was supposed to be a wrap-up of the best horror movies of 2023 episode, but there are still movies I haven't been able to get around to that I wanted to see before I recorded that episode. I'm down to just a few left. There's Birth, Rebirth, there's Influencer, there's Cobweb, which somehow I missed. And there is one more Wednesday in this year, so I'm going to take advantage of that, finish off my list, and then drop that episode for the final episode of the year. So this is kind of an impromptu episode, but it's based on a subject that really fascinates me, which is changing your opinion on movies, whether either way, whether you initially really liked or loved it and then came to think less of it, or vice versa. Now, from my point of view, you're allowed to change your opinion on horror movies. Part of what I love about movies is they're complicated. They're more complicated than short films. They're just longer. They have more to them. And in some cases, they're works of art. They have layers. And they also kind of change with time. Some of them hit way different 10, 20 years out from when they were made than when you first saw them. And you also change with time. So I know 18-year-old me is a lot different than the current me. So there's that. You're also allowed to be wrong about movies and admit it. And I mean, just wrong from your own point of view, right? Since this is all a pretty subjective thing. But especially if you're doing things at volume. I came across this astounding clip the other day of Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, and Ebert was saying that Home Alone 3 was the best Home Alone movie in the franchise. And it looked like Gene Siskel's soul left his body when Ebert said it. And it's clearly just wrong what Ebert's saying. But that's the thing, is if you do things at volume, I mean, these guys were writing or doing hundreds of reviews a year. If I only did one podcast episode per year talking about one movie, unless the movie starred Rob Schneider, I'd have like a 50-50 chance of being right about whether it was good or not. My chance would be much higher if Rob was in it, because I would just know that it was bad. But barring a guidepost as certain as that, you just never know, right? So because I do a lot of reviews, and because there are a lot of people that we like and follow and podcasts that we listen to that do a lot of reviews, if you do a bunch a year, you're going to get stuff wrong occasionally, and then you get to look back on it and be like, oh. Now, because this is an impromptu episode, I didn't get to ask the community in advance, so we're going to flip our usual procedure, and I'm going to ask after this episode and see what movies people come up with. And I'm also really interested in what kind of movie is more likely to be one that people change their minds about. Like, is there a pattern to the kind of movie or the kind of director that makes things where people, I mean, John Carpenter seems like the most obvious example, where a lot of times his movies were greeted with indifference or even hostility when they first came out among critics and horror fans. And then over time, people look back and they're like, whoa, banger after banger after banger. Whereas you have someone like Alfred Hitchcock, who with a few exceptions was pretty much just acclaimed and successful in a popular sense throughout almost his entire career until the end. So let's explore and dig into this a little bit. One of the first movies that came to mind for me for this is Halloween Kills. I hated Halloween Kills when I first saw it. It actually kind of made my skin crawl with how much I disliked it. And given the fact that its director, David Gordon Green, didn't exactly cover himself with glory with the recent The Exorcist, The Believer, it's even more unlikely time to kind of go and be like, hey, I see qualities there that I didn't see there before. But for some strange reason, I do. I've done an almost complete 180 on Halloween Kills. I have a rough relationship with the whole trilogy I really liked Halloween 2018 when it first came out, but Halloween has always been my favorite of the major franchises. Well, that's not exactly true. So, like, I think Elm Street's my favorite franchise overall because I really appreciate the creativity of it. But Halloween was one of the first movies to truly terrify me and turn me into a horror fan. And Michael Myers always has had a special place in my heart. So when 2018 came out and I saw it in a theater, and it felt good. It felt like one of the better sequels in the franchise. It felt like there was enough going on in there that was good to be like, oh, this is the tradition has returned. We can go see a movie with Michael Myers in it that we haven't seen before around the Halloween season, and it's not embarrassing. And some of my response to that movie was just how I've internalized the concept of Michael Myers. It's the shadowy, abstract, almost like existential nature of him, as opposed to like what Freddy Krueger became later in the franchise as like the stand-up comedian horror icon, or like Jigsaw, who you almost end up knowing too much about over the course of the franchise, or Friday the 13th, where the franchise moves so far away from where it originally started that it almost became unrecognizable. Michael Myers, even in the worst moments of the worst movies of the Halloween franchise, still could lurk in the shadows. And even if they screwed up the mask, if you made it like in the shadows enough where you couldn't really tell, and it's just a silhouette, like whatever, I could feel a little bit of that old nostalgia for the how terrifying I had found the original movie and to some extent the immediate sequel, Halloween 2. And Halloween 2018 kept Michael Myers pretty shadowy. It kept him with like very little background information being added throughout the course of the movie. It just focused on the movements and the killings and the like out of the blue nature to the characters who were being attacked of what was happening, and that creeping sense of dread around that season and around Haddonfield. So even though it's not a perfect movie by any means, it kept close enough to kind of what I think of are the things that I enjoy about Halloween that I was fine with it, right? And then Halloween Kills came out, and all I could see were its flaws. All I could hear in my head was Evil Dies Tonight over and over again. All I could see was a crowd of people running around chasing a guy who is the last person on Earth that you could mistake for Michael Myers for some reason. It just, in a weird way, it felt like kind of the parts that I disliked or the DNA I disliked in Brightburn. Halloween Kills felt almost like comic booky, almost like Marvel had crept into the Halloween franchise somehow in some weird way. The cartoonish Technicolor part of it. And then they did the same thing to Jamie Lee inevitably that they did in the original Halloween 2, where they kind of sidelined her, left her in a hospital for most of the movie. And so the movie just felt kind of like the heart had been taken out of it a little bit. There were just over-the-top comedy elements with Big John and Little John. When I walked out, I just was like, I might just be done with this franchise. I was not on board. But there's this one weird thing that lingered in my mind for a few months after I saw Halloween Kills, which is when I think back about the original Halloween and I think about how much it was, how terrifying it was to me at the time. A lot of it was, to be honest, the music, because the music is some of the most effective music ever put in a horror film. But all the rest of it is John Carpenter's brilliant direction and brilliant choices that he was making in the movie, along with a powerhouse performance by Jamie Lee and all the really good side characters. But because I associated Michael Myers with fear, actual fear, one of the few major well-known horror movies that's ever really rattled me, I noticed that in my imagination, Michael Myers was more fierce, and more violent than he really is in the original movie. It's like what happens with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where a lot of people who first saw it remembered it as very gory when it's not very gory at all. And then, of course, because I've seen all of the other Halloween movies, I have an amalgam of images in my head of my favorite Michael Myers moments. I realized that the Michael Myers that I carry around in my head and in my horror fan heart is not the Michael Myers just from the first film. It's not even a Michael Myers that's in any of the films entirely. It's kind of the one I built up in my imagination. And then I realized that the Michael Myers that's presented in Halloween Kills is the closest to the thing that I've been carrying around as this is what I think of him as. He is absolutely savage in Halloween Kills. He's a weird combination of slow and quick, which has always been one of the most unsettling and off-putting traits of Michael Myers, is that you can't clock him because he's either behind where you think he's going to be because he's moving slower than that, or all of a sudden he's where he never should be and you're screwed. He's just remorseless and unafraid. He's what I imagine that the character Quint thinks Bruce the shark in Jaws is in his head. When Quint thinks about the perfect killing machine shark that he thinks is his opponent, after all the trauma he's been through with sharks, after the USS Indianapolis and that magnificent monologue, the shark that's in Quint's head is a lot like the Michael Myers that's in my head and is very much like the Michael Myers that is in Halloween Kills. And we all know among the modern movies, this is where it's going to peak, because Michael Myers is not going to get stronger in Halloween Ends. The opening flashback sequence of Halloween Kills is impeccably done. It's gorgeous looking, and it's really cool. It made me want them to do just like a whole flashback film. The beginning is like a little self-contained mini masterpiece. It's kind of like how there's a short movie that secretly sits at the beginning of Jason Lives that's like a little Frankenstein short film to whet your appetite before you get into the slasher part of the movie. The firefighter sequence is undeniably great, but my favorite chunk of the movie is the part that goes from when the characters led by Anthony Michael Hall leave the bar and go out on their first vigilante hunt for Michael Myers. The doctor and nurse, the scene where they get confronted in a car, and then there's this astonishing self-shooting moment by one of the characters. The killings of the older couple in the house, the finding the kids in the playground, just openly defiant of the warnings not to be out on Halloween, which is exactly how I would have been as a kid their age. The weird chemistry between Lonnie and Tommy when they're on the hunt, which is strangely endearing. Allison is at her most believable during this middle section of this movie of, I think, the entire franchise or the entire reboot trilogy. And then my favorite moments in the movie are the quiet stalking moments with this beautiful dark forest scene where Michael is stalking Lindsay and then moves on and doesn't kill her, which almost never happens in not only Halloween, but any of the major franchise movies where a character hides successfully and the killer just moves on, which gives it this odd touch of realism in such an over-the-top film. But the amazing music that John Carpenter wrote for this, the whole it's just such a gorgeous sequence. There's a stone bridge and the dark woods and the night and the creaking sound of the carousel with the dead bodies on it and the Halloween masks. And oh, it's just some of my favorite stuff. And then, of course, there's the mob ganging up on Michael and quote unquote killing him. And there's no profound message here. Like, I see some people trying to read into, like, the more killing Michael does, the stronger he gets and all that. But that's, like, mechanics. That's not like, this isn't like Rosemary's Baby or something. It's a straight-ahead slasher film. But there is something interesting happening where Haddonfield, the worst Haddonfield gets, the uglier, the more divided, the more overconfident, the more vengeful, they think they can snuff out violence with violence. And the more they try, the worse the violence gets. And when Michael Myers rises up from the beating the mob gave him and takes his immediate revenge, I don't know. I just had such a better time, such a really fun time on my rewatch of this movie, way more than I ever would have expected to. So I have really changed my mind on Halloween Kills. And, you know, speaking of the John Carpenter-ness of this, another movie that I have changed my mind a lot on over the years is John Carpenter's Christine. Now, like pretty much any other horror fan, I would imagine, I had a fun time watching Christine when I was younger. Enjoyed a lot of it. Enjoyed the car, obviously. Enjoyed the music. But it just felt like lesser Carpenter, right? It felt like his, like, 10th best movie to me. It didn't have the grandeur of something like The Thing. I mean, The Thing is such an amazing film that I've always thought, in a weird way, if, you know, Earth was wiped out and aliens came down and discovered, like, artifacts from Earth afterwards, and one of them was, like, a DVD or Blu-ray of The Thing, and they figured out how to play it and they watched it, it might go some way to explaining what happened to us, because it contains the best and the worst of humanity in it. It contains by the ending, the best we can fight to is like a draw. We can't get a win, right? We just get a draw. I mean, sure, from MacReady's point of view, it's a win preventing the thing from getting out and getting the rest of humanity. And his self-sacrifice is super noble. So I do give that as a win, but it's a really bleak one. It's a really bleak one from where he's at. And it took the people so long to figure out how to cooperate with each other and not be suspicious of each other and not turn on each other that they put themselves way behind. They were as much their own enemies as the thing ever was. And that's something humanity is really good at doing to itself. If aliens were thinking to themselves, trying to figure out what these humans were that had once been, and they were like, huh, I wonder, they acted scared a lot. I wonder what scared them. They could watch Halloween and get a long way to the answer of what gives human beings nightmares, right? It's death. It's something threatening in the shadows. It's something mysterious that you don't understand that is the biggest threat. No one's watching, the aliens aren't watching Christine and getting any answers except for, wow, that vehicle, even though it can't fly, is pretty cool. Even for us UFO building motherfuckers, we got to recognize that the Plymouth Fury was a pretty good machine. I also didn't find it as scary as a lot of other John Carpenter movies like The Thing and Halloween and Prince of Darkness, etc. So I thought it was good. I thought it was fine. I thought it was fun, but I didn't think much more of it than that back then. But now I love it so much more than I did. I mean, first of all, tech coming to life and killing us and taking its revenge against humanity is somehow a lot more pertinent now than it was, I think, when the movie first came out. I just saw like a John Oliver piece on Tesla, and it was showing someone trying to take one of the self-driving Teslas down the road, and then the camera zooms in as the car's malfunctioning and running red lights, and it zooms real close, and there's just this couple out there with a stroller just taking their baby out for a walk as the Tesla like veers and whizzes by and just misses them. Yeah, Christine's kind of relevant in a weird way. But there's something else that has really grown on me and turned this into one of my favorite horror movies. And it's how dour and gray and bleak and colorless modern horror is becoming. We were getting hints of this happening with movies like The Ring and The Mist, but we are in a full-fledged A24 era of horror now. We are in the age of the Hereditaries and the Lighthouse and Skinamarink and trauma horror. And it's not just in horror. I mean, the difference between the colors and the vivacity of like the original Avengers films to where they ended up with things like the Eternals or whatever. Things have just gotten a lot more serious, a lot less fun, and kind of in a weird way, a little bit of ashamed of what they actually are. It feels like a lot of the elevated horror, and I don't want to get into the whole elevated horror argument. I like a lot of elevated horror movies. I'm the biggest fan of The Witch ever, and most of you hate it, right? So, like, I get that it's not that part of it. It's the fact that the elevated horror, to have an impact, has to have like in music, it would be like a really, really low rumbling bass, right? Like it almost has to be a little bit ponderous. It has to wear you down. It has to, because it's also wearing the characters down. One of the best examples of something like this is the movie The Empty Man, which is just this 2-hour desolation fest of the most like morbid, and it's not even like it's that extreme a movie. It's not. It's just kind of like the depressing parts of like the lead up to the end of The Mist extended out to a 2-hour movie in vibes. And because horror is becoming so much of that in the modern times, it is so unbelievably refreshing to have Christine with her wicked sense of humor, with people trying to break into her while she's turning up her radio and playing "You Can Keep On Knocking, But You Can't Come In." And in my favorite, her defiantly playing an anthem while she's getting pulverized and crushed, saying "Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay," which is one of my favorite uses of a song ever in a horror movie ever. It's just like sheer self-destructive violence, audio violence on her part, because she's losing, but she's never going to give up. She's never going to accept that she's losing to the last second of consciousness. It's like the Terminator with his little red eye that like flickers out and then reboots and comes back on. And we just don't get horror characters who do stuff like that for now. It's at this time. It's like mind-boggling to imagine like Ethan Hawke's character from The Black Phone, you know, brought to his doom and firing up like "Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay." Or like, I guess for, you know, him, he'd be firing up like Led Zeppelin's "Immigrant Song" or like "Running with the Devil" from Van Halen or whatever. But like that character would never do that. He would never have that amount of malicious exuberance to throw out a challenge and go down with an anthem blaring. And the acting is just so much better than you remember for a movie that comes off as kind of silly at the time. Keith Gordon is phenomenal. John Stockwell and Alexandra Paul are amazing. Robert Prosky, who plays Darnell, the garage owner, is incredible. Harry Dean Stanton is stealing scenes left and right like a motherfucker. Pretty much the only acting, Buddy Repperton is hilarious. And his buddies are perfectly cast. The only characters that I don't find that believable in this movie are Arnie's parents. And I also don't find the caterpillar that played the bulldozer at the end convincing, because I don't think that thing could take Christine. But whatever, that's just, maybe he's just a bad actor. And we can't forget Robert's Blossom as LeBay, the current owner of Christine, as the movie starts. Just packed with talent in these like peripheral roles. But in like our current sort of gray horror times, that just beautiful, defiant, red and white colored hell machine called Christine is something that I've come to appreciate so much more than when I first saw it. Now, you guys might not recognize the next one as a horror movie. I sure do. I think it's a horror movie for the same reason that I think Mulholland Drive is a horror movie, and for the same reason that I think Ty West, The Sacrament, is a horror movie. But I'm thinking about Stanley Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut. Now again, and I think we're discovering a pattern here, I thought of this as really lesser Stanley Kubrick when I first saw it. And maybe that is part of the pattern, where you're just comparing movies to the other works by the same director that you've come to like or know, like I did with John Carpenter's Christine, comparing it to The Thing and Halloween, etc. And when you're comparing a film to The Shining and Full Metal Jacket and 2001, well, that film's probably going to be in trouble by comparison, because those are really hard to beat movies in terms of quality. So Eyes Wide Shut felt, you know, interesting, fun, weird. But I kind of actively disliked it when I was done with it the first time I saw it. Now, there's a couple of reasons I'm talking about this here. One is I've massively changed my mind on the film. Two is that I found it a lot scarier than I did when I first saw it on rewatch and really thinking through what is happening, actually happening in the movie, including a really horrifying hint of what's going on at the very end of the film, which gives me literal chills to think about, and the fact that it's the most beautiful non-traditional Christmas movie ever made. Now, if you're looking for like nostalgia Christmas, like someone who makes Christmas look like fun and festive on film, you've got Home Alone, you've got Christmas Story, if you're really going for the nostalgia thing. You've even got, like we discussed in the previous episode, Black Christmas 2006, which does a really good job of giving kind of like that beautiful, if a little ominous, Christmas vibe. But Christmas is so ever present in Eyes Wide Shut. There's almost not a single shot without Christmas in it. In a longish movie, it's kind of amazing. You don't really notice it when you first see it. It's like David Fincher slipping in like product shots all throughout Fight Club. In Eyes Wide Shut, Christmas is everywhere but subliminally, and sometimes not subliminally. It's in your face. I'm telling you, if you haven't seen it or haven't seen it a long time, fire Eyes Wide Shut up and just get through like the first 15 minutes to the point where Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman go to the party they're invited to. And the Christmas decorations at this party, the Christmas lighting, the staircase in particular, is some of the most ravishing Christmas visuals anyone will ever film ever. But Stanley Kubrick knew what he was doing. He was doing the same thing that Wes Craven was doing when he made Freddy's sweater green and red, because Wes Craven had seen in a psychology thing that those two colors together really kind of mess with the human mind, because they don't belong together or they don't go together. They mess with like our optical system on a subliminal level. There's something about the Christmas element in this Eyes Wide Shut world that is just all wrong. It's not festive at all. It's like the mist. It's like the fog rolling in the mist, except for it's like Christmas colors everywhere. But it's not comforting. It's kind of like horrifying, because everyone in this movie is on a downward trajectory, or it has completely no morals, or is an actual monster, like ethically and in some cases morally, and just like outright, you know, destroying people, crumpling them up, throwing them away like they have no value at all. And all around them is just this ever present, like soft Christmas haze that's in a place that it doesn't belong. And that's the thing about Eyes Wide Shut. Everything's crosswired. I mean, he told us that in the title. It's supposed to be Eyes Wide Open. What the hell are Eyes Wide Shut? They can't be shut and wide at the same time. It's a contradiction. This is a movie that has a full-on lengthy, almost completely naked orgy that completely is asexual. Like the least thrilling orgy ever put on film somehow. It's got characters who come across as really friendly and then turn out to be complete sociopaths. It's got business owners pimping out their daughters. It's got doctors being brought in to help keep people going just for a few days until they drop from something more horrible that's going to happen to them. So the healing isn't even helping. It's not healing. It's just like it's the comfortably numb Pink Floyd effect. I just need a little more drugs so the show can go on. That's what physicians are doing in this movie. The death of the person who tries to help Tom Cruise's character is horrifying. And the morgue scene is even more horrifying after her death. It's one of the coldest and most sinister things Stanley Kubrick has ever filmed. And in the end of the movie, well, you have two parents Christmas shopping with their little daughter, and the whole movie has been teaching us that little girls are being groomed to be like some kind of sexual possessions. You have these two parents walking around this fancy Christmas store shopping, and they're so absorbed with themselves and their own adventures that they went through and their own like trying to figure out how to bring themselves back together as a couple, that they don't notice that their little daughter wanders off and she's framed by two strangers that we met before in the movie at the house where one of the villains was. They're just there inexplicably, like following them. They frame around their little daughter, the Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman don't notice, and then they all vanish off screen, and then we never see her daughter again while the couple is just obliviously talking to each other. Like, is the little girl gone? Is she kidnapped? Is this some kind of signal about what her future is going to be? It's terrifying, but quietly so. So yeah, now Eyes Wide Shut has become one of my very favorite Stanley Kubrick films and a movie that I watch every year at the Christmas season. And speaking of Christmas season, here's a weird one. This isn't horror, and I'm not going to talk about it for more than a minute, I promise. But I changed my mind on It's a Wonderful Life, which felt like the hallmark of old-timey Christmas movies to me growing up. But the reason I changed my mind on it is The Exorcist 3. So The Exorcist 3 has this weird undercurrent of It's a Wonderful Life. It comes from the original book, The Exorcist, and then the movie, the Exorcist movie itself, is in its DNA, where the two of the main characters, the cop and the priest, every year go to see It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas. And then there's this famous moment where the serial killer gruesomely kills someone, takes all the blood out of their body. It's Brad Dourif playing it, or Jason Miller, or both, I guess, depending on how you look at it. And then writes in blood, It's a Wonderful Life with two L's, above the corpse of the cop's best friend. And it's because I really started to sense when I was watching Exorcist 3 and reading about Exorcist 3, because I became obsessed with the movie, that there's a darkness at the heart of It's a Wonderful Life. Like, I was like, what is this movie doing here inside this incredibly grim sequel to one of the most terrifying horror movies ever made? Like, one of the darkest worlds ever created in terms of like a horror universe in the Exorcist series. What is It's a Wonderful Life keep popping up in here for? Like, it didn't make any sense. It'd be like having a Charlie Brown Christmas in there, but it wasn't. It's not like that. It's because It's a Wonderful Life is actually really dark in a lot of parts and kind of turns into a horror movie in its last third before the famous Auld Lang Syne ending. So I gave it another chance, and it's a lot darker and much more morbid than you'd expect from a Christmas movie. So I've since come to really appreciate, you know, that part of it. But that was a change of heart that I got, not from rewatching It's a Wonderful Life itself. It's I got from a horror movie saying, hey, this Christmas movie is my spiritual brother. Like, this movie is my kin. This Christmas movie you think is just a light Christmas movie, it actually belongs over here in my Exorcist universe. And I was like, what? Now, so far, I've only talked about movies where I've changed my mind for them getting better, but it does work both directions, right? Like, I wanted to give one example of the other way, which is The Conjuring 2. So I really liked The Conjuring 2 when it first came out. I actually liked it more than the first Conjuring, which is, you know, objectively an excellently crafted horror movie, whatever you think of it. But The Conjuring 2 really struck me for some reason. I liked its atmosphere. I don't know. And Valak as, you know, like kind of like the presence was so fresh at the time, or I don't know, that might not be the right word, but like it isn't what it is now. Right. So after like the fucking Nun and the Nun 2 and like the Conjuring 3, and then my weird kick I've gotten on lately, kind of like reading up and studying and watching things about the Satanic Panic. I did extended thing on this amazing documentary in an earlier podcast episode for this show. The documentary is called Satan Wants You. And, you know, it kind of butts up against like what con artists and like just really bad people, Ed and Lorraine Warren were. So I went back and watched The Conjuring 2. And while it's by no means like the worst movie ever made, I would no longer say it's better than the first Conjuring. And I honestly turned it off halfway through. Like I remembered how the rest of it went. So I didn't even end up like finishing the entire thing. Maybe I'll give it another chance someday, like in a fuller thing. But anyway, at this point, it's definitely something that came down some notches in my estimation. So that's it for now of my list of movies, that horror movies that I've changed my mind on one way or another. I'm curious if you listening out there allow yourself to change your mind on films or allow others to change their mind, if you find that interesting as an idea or if it's something that happens to you ever. Really curious because I don't see a lot of people talking about this as a concept. I think, you know, we have such a large community on Facebook. There's a lot of activity there, a lot of comments going back and forth, and there's a lot of passion arguing, which honestly is part of the reason that page is there. And I'm not going to lie, I love it. I love to debate and I love to learn things and I love to see other people do the same. So, you know, it would be inherently foolish to start a thing like a podcast and not think that you have a chance to change people's minds, or not you changing minds, I guess, more like just kind of honoring the fact that there have been so many podcasts that I've listened to, excellent podcasts like Faculty of Horror or Bloody Good Horror, that have changed my mind, or at least pried my closed mind open enough to give something I thought maybe I wouldn't watch a chance, or something that I had seen and judged, to give it a chance in a different kind of mindset. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But for me, it's always fun and refreshing when it does. So I'm just curious how you all feel about that notion. And I think because there's so much discussion on our pages, I think the heat, the bad heat, because there's good heat. Like you can fight for, I'll fight for shit all day long. As you guys know, like I'll fight for The Witch even when I'm outnumbered 200-1, right? As you guys know, probably too much, but forget the good heat. There is some bad heat sometimes in these arguments and discussions. And I feel like the heat would be a couple notches lower if people had in the back of their minds while they were kind of saying their opinions that this is just kind of my current opinion. And there's the possibility it might change. It might change by a couple shades of color, or it might flip around and do a total 180. Who knows over time. But, you know, people who are 100% certain they're right and always going to be right, they're like they have the most bad heat in their arguing. So I think if this is something that you believe in, is something that could actually help make discussions more interesting, more community building, and a little less divisive. I don't know. What the fuck do I know? That's just my hope. I do have a great review to report. First one in a couple weeks, so I'm really excited it came across on the Apple platform. So thank you to Kryptonian Orphan. Love the name. Five-star review. Great pod. Said, I found this pod while searching for Godzilla Minus One content. Great episode. I'm going through the pod from the beginning. Lots of great reviews, episodes, highly recommended. If you can, a few movies that I love that seem to get overlooked. Splice, Night of the Demons, The Entity, The Monster, Jacob's Ladder, and Angel Heart. I've got lots more to recommend, but this is a good start. Thanks and keep up the good work. Thank you for the great review. I appreciate it. The goal is to get to a nice, healthy, round number of reviews. We're not that far away on Spotify or the Apple platform, both. So if you have time and haven't placed a review and you enjoy what you're hearing, I couldn't appreciate it more. As for the movies you named, I did an entire episode on Angel Heart with one of my favorite other podcasts as a guest called Manic Movie Monday. So you might want to check that out, even though I wasn't really happy with my audio there. I'm kind of hard on myself that way. But I felt like the content was good. The discussion was really fun. I am planning to talk about The Entity in a future episode about horror movies that traumatized people, because I've seen that movie pop up in our community in quite a few comments on movies from people from a certain generation who found that movie traumatizing when it came out. And I've always had The Monster 2016 on my list. I loved the trailer, and for some reason I've never seen it. So thank you so much for the recommendation. And if anyone else out there wants to give a review and put recommendations in, I will cover them on this podcast when I see them one way or another. So that's it for this. I'm not going to talk to you until Christmas. So if you're celebrating it, enjoy it. Have a bloody one. Keep your eyes wide shut if you can. And then next week, to finish out the year, we will do our wrap up of the best horror movies of 2023. I'm excited to check the remaining ones off my list and get to it. So thank you so much for listening. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.